Well, I was born in 1916. There was four of us in the family, and my father owned a shoe store in Winnipeg, and we moved to Stonewall in 1924 on a farm. And like lots of other kids, worked on farms and up until war was declared. It's about, I was out in Rosetown, Saskatchewan when war was declared, and riding freights. So came back to Winnipeg and joined the Winnipeg Grenadiers on 2nd of October, 39.
Okay. And what was your early training like in the Grenadiers, and where was this done?
Well, we, early training was done at Minto Armories. Mm-hmm. And then in the spring of 40, of course, we left for Jamaica. But we moved, I should say, we moved into Fort Osborne Barracks in December of 39, after the first div had pulled out, PPCLI. So we moved in there, and then we trained there during the winter, and in the spring of 40 we left for Jamaica.
What type of training was done in Winnipeg?
Well, we didn't have any equipment. We were using everything from the First War. Our uniforms were all First War uniforms. It was at that time, we were a machine gun battalion, and we didn't have any trucks. We had the odd Vickers gun, but they just drew pictures of the box of a truck on the at the drill hall there in Fort Osborne, and how to mount the, where to place the gun and mount and all this stuff. It was all done with chalk on the floor, and there was no actual equipment at all. No.
And Jamaica, what was your trip like to Jamaica, and what was done there for the training?
Well, the trip to Jamaica was really something that we don't forget, because coming from the prairies and on a boat. But when we got there, I was with the transport part of the army, you know, and my particular job there was driving ship's guards to any neutral boats that were coming in into the harbor had to have a guard on them. So one of our particular jobs was to drive the ship guard out. They would go out in a skiff and meet the boat and bring it in, and then when the boat went out, we'd have to go out where they call Port Royal, which is a big peninsula, runs away out in the harbor, you see, and we'd pick the guard up and bring them back, you see. And we had a certain amount of internment camp guard to do. We had the crew off the, what's the name of that boat? It was sunk in South America.
Graspe.
That's right. So we had the crew off them in the internment camp, and we had to do a certain amount of guard. Actually, we didn't do much training in Jamaica. It was just strictly garrison duty, and we were seemed to be always short of men for all the duties, one thing and another. But it was, back on it now, it was a good experience. We were mad at the time because we joined up to go overseas. We didn't join up to go to the West Indies, and we had this chip on our shoulder, at least a lot of us did, because we'd been sent down there. But that's...
And when did you come back to Canada?
Well, oh gosh. It was in the fall of 45, but we got stopped in Guam. I was put in a hospital there in the fleet, Navy hospital.
Excuse me, when you came back from Jamaica.
Oh, when did we come back from Jamaica?
Yeah.
Gee, I think it was in September of 41, somewhere in there. I was on the first draft back, mm-hmm. And we had a good trip. We had Major Hook in charge, and there was only about 50 Canadians on. And when we got back here, they gave us leave, and then we moved into the Robinson building, mm-hmm. And kind of manned that when the main body came back, you see. When they went on leave, we were kind of looking after that, and And but it, I think that was September of 41. Then in October of 41, I made a big mistake and got married. But we took a Bren gun carrier course. Oh, I'm not sure whether that was when I first came back or shortly after. I think we were only back here about 6 weeks, I guess, when we left again. But anyway, we took this Bren gun carrier course. Of course, we ended up, we didn't have any Bren gun carriers, but we took it anyway out of Port Osborne. And, very hard to remember just exactly.
And was it in October that the men were called back to report to report on duty?
Well, the third draft. You see, I came back on the first draft. Mm-hmm. Then there was a main draft, and then the third draft. I think they were only here about 10 days, and they got called back to take off again. There's a lot of bitterness over that because, of course, we didn't know at the time what the reason was or anything, but a lot of the fellows figured that they were entitled to more than 10 days after spending a year and a half or for near a year and a half in the West Indies. So there's a lot of bitterness over that, and some of them weren't there when we pulled out, to put it that way, you know, they just weren't around. We pulled out for China.
And what was the trip like? You were all told to report to duty, and then were you put on the train the next day, or how long did they give you to report?
Well, you see, I didn't get any notice of reporting because I was on the first draft. I had my 2 weeks leave, and I was back in barracks. Now, when they called in the third draft that had just been home a few days, they didn't have much time. I'd say maybe 1 or 2 days. I can't remember exactly, but they didn't have much time. And a lot of them, their home was a long way from Winnipeg, and you know, they just nicely got home and they had to turn around and come back, put it that way. But I can't remember exactly how much time they had.
And what was it like? You were put on a train and heading west, but nobody knew the destination.
No, we didn't figure we were going to go to a war area because a lot of the officers had golf clubs and tennis rackets and stuff like that, and so we figured maybe we were going to another area such as Jamaica or something like that. And I think that the actual top command of the regiment figured that too, because and if things hadn't started the way they did, it's probably what we would have ended up being in a garrison for the rest of the war. I don't know. But the Japs changed that and they sided in with Germany.
When you got to Vancouver, you were put right on a boat.
Mm-hmm.
What was your feelings at this time, and what did you think of the boat and the conditions on it?
Well, the boat was a very nice boat. It was an Australian passenger ship. There may have been a little conversion on it. I doubt if there was much, except they put a bunch of wooden tables down the hold, and they slung hammocks from the ceiling for the NCOs and privates, or whatever you want to call it, other ranks. The officers all had nice cabins and, you know, staterooms, and they fed us, I think the first morning was mutton stew for breakfast, and but before we had breakfast, we got on about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and there was a lot of dissension. There was a big rumpus. A bunch of us got off the boat, maybe 200 men out of when we have strength of about 2,000 on that boat and somewhere like 400 on the Rupert, I guess, or convoy. I can't remember exact figures, but we got off the boat and they called in the Provo Corps and There was quite a bit of stink on the dock that night anyway, and they eventually got us back on, and they pulled her out about a mile or two, I suppose, and laid anchor there to keep us from getting back. But there was some fellows never did get back on the boat. They just took off, and it was a schmozzle, there's no doubt about it. Nobody knew what they were doing. They didn't have a clue, and I imagine that part of the answer now, after reading history, that our equipment should have been there. It wasn't there. It's hard to blame anybody for it, because I imagine the top officials, they wondered where the transport was. They didn't know either, you know. I don't want to start into the government, but the fault lays there right to the whole thing, right from start to finish. It's nothing but government buggering up everything, you know.
What was the trip like to Hong Kong? And during this trip, was there any announcement made as to the destination?
No. There was no announcement made until we... Oh, I forget. See, we were 3 weeks on the water. We might have been out 2 weeks, and we got a lecture one day from Lieutenant Burkett. I think his name was Burkett. Anyway, he was killed over there. That we better take things a little more seriously than we had been in the past, because we might have to fight our way off the boat. Now, or he got his information or anything, but that's what I can remember.
Mm-hmm. And what was the arrival like in Hong Kong?
Well, the arrival in Hong Kong was like anything else, you know. We got off the boat and made our way, paraded down to Cham Tho Po Barracks. But can't remember any incidents there.
And was there any training done before the actual battle broke out?
Well, you see, I was in transport. I drove a truck all the time. We're in Jamaica. Then we took this Bren gun carrier course, and they made us carrier drivers. The old transport guys, each one was detailed to a certain company for carrier drivers. So we ended up with no transport personnel. So they went eeny, meeny, miny, mo, and they picked out a bunch of guys for transport. They didn't know whether they could drive trucks or whether they couldn't. But of course, we had no trucks anyway. So then, when the fight actually started, they commandeered a bunch of Chinese trucks. When they were long wheelbase trucks, and they couldn't possibly get around the hills in Hong Kong, it was impossible. They were too long. And then when they get them commandeered, a lot of these fellows never drove a truck in their life. So they came all through the hills and they picked up the old transport drivers. They were on roadblocks and one thing and another. And put us on the trucks. Brought us back into transport because there was no carriers anyway. So that just shows you the kind of the disorganization of the whole thing.
Where were you when the actual battle broke out?
Well, I was at Wan Chai Gap. Yeah, they moved us up on a Sunday afternoon. No reason. We were in Cham Tho Po, you see. When we first landed there, went to Cham Tho Po, and then we spent our days, which weren't very many of them, but praying up and down, saluting to the right and saluting to the left, and never out in the hills. There was the odd party had been, or some of the senior NCOs were out running around the hills looking things over, but the rest of us, we'd never been in the hills. See, Hong Kong is flat along the harbor, and then it's really mountainous. And we didn't know anything about the hills. So this Sunday afternoon, I guess this would be about the 6th of December, I suppose. So it was a day difference anyway between here and there. They said, okay, move the camp. So anyway, we walked up the hills. through little trails and one thing another. We had no transport. We had maybe we had them old EMP rifles, and of course they switched our rifles when we got back to Winnipeg, and we hadn't got them sighted in. We hadn't anything. So we had our Enfield rifles, and we prayed up through little paths up into the hills, and pitched tents for the night. The morning, we take all the canvas down. War had been declared. And of course, we didn't take it too seriously. We thought, who the heck's wrong now again? And it was Chamozzle, so, but we weren't long finding out that they were right. They started to bomb us and one thing another. But the barracks that we'd left on the Sunday afternoon, they attacked that Monday morning just as right as well. As far as I'm concerned, it was the same time as they hit Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. But there was one British soldier killed in a Chinese janitor or something like that. I can't really remember, but there was very little loss of life because we got out. Yeah. But if we hadn't, we'd have had it.
Yeah. And what sort of things happened during the battle between December the 7th and the 25th when the surrender was declared, and where were you at this time?
Well, we were... I was on the regimental rifle truck from the 7th of December, I guess, till the 19th. Yeah. The 19th of December, and the Japs landed. They made it across this half a mile from the mainland to the island under a smoke screen. They'd set a bunch of oil tanks on the shore on fire. And they were smoking, and they got across that night. And myself and Eddie Smeltz from Elgin, we left one giant gap with two truckloads of men, and we went in with a guide to Jardine's Lookout. And unknowing to us, we went through the front line. They let us through. And there was no action, there was no firing. Might have been rumbles in the distance, but there was nothing close. And we got in there and the Jardine's Lookout. So we hung around there all night, sleeping and half asleep in the cabs, and the men were dispersed. Lieutenant Burkett was in charge of that party. And at daybreak, they opened up on us, on both sides. So I set fire to my truck. We couldn't get them out, and we didn't want them to have it. So I took my gas mask, and I didn't need that anyway. The only thing we had that was part of military equipment that we didn't need, the things we needed we didn't have. And I stuck it down the gas tank and got her saturated with like the shoulder harness parts, you know. And got her soaked in gas and set fire to it, and I threw it in the cab and got the truck going good. And I had the Thompson submachine gun. Forget how many rounds I had, but not that many. So I took that with me, and I can't remember what happened to Smeltz's truck, or I can't remember that now. Anyway, we tried, when we hung around trying to get out all day, everybody on their own. Didn't know where we were going, we hadn't a clue where they were. And they were sniping at us. It was, you know, you'd hear them, and they were coming damn close too. And I remember crawling over a ledge and looking down, and the reason I mentioned this is the only chance I got to shoot in them, and they were sitting around, these bunch of Japs, they were sitting around cooking some rice over a fire, and there was about 20 of them. And I didn't have that many rounds in this submachine gun, and I just spewed them. I don't know whether I got any or whether I didn't, but anyway, I took off at the high port. But about 6 or 7 o'clock, I guess, that afternoon. We couldn't possibly get out. And we came across this shack up on the hills. It was something to do with the army, but I can't remember now. I know when we got into this place, well, we went in, there was quite a few more Canadians in there. And, well, we decided to stay there. So, did we stay there all night, or it seemed to me we did. I can't remember exactly. But there would be about 50 guys in there. Was two Lieutenant Mitchells there. And, there was Smeltz was there, the other driver, and myself. And there was about 50 in there anyway. So, I think we... we got in there, that's right. And an hour or so after we got in there, the Japs came through there. They were just like ants. And they surrounded the place, and this officer came in, and he pulled us all out, everybody out. And they landed us up on the road. It was quite a grade on the road. And made us all kneel down, and then they started sticking guys with bayonets and everything. And I was in the front, and there was Jackie Auburn on one side of me and Delorier on the other. And they went into there and they stuck them with bayonets, everything. And then I looked down, and the actual blood was just running down the road between her knees. And it never touched me. I don't know why. Jackie Auburn, he's alive. He gets stuck on that. Well, and when the kid, his kid, just above his kidney, I guess. And Delorme, they cut him down his head here. His scalp just fell over, of course, they killed him. And there wasn't many of us got out of that. And then the ones that were able to walk around after that, they were going to shoot us. So they landed us up in front of a firing squad. And, well, we figured we had it, you see. No way that we can get out of this. They'd kill so many now. Save us. And I think that, this Jap officer, I didn't know he was an officer at the time. Never saw a Jap soldier in my life. But anyway, he had one of these Suwari swords. He'd come along and he let a roar at him, and these guys dropped their rifles. And that was it. They wired us up together and... When the hell was that mortar bomb came through that shack? I guess they took us back to the shack, that's right. They took us back into the shack. Yeah, and they stood guard on us all night. And then in the morning, our own mortars saw this concentration of Japanese. And they opened up on them. And, They landed a big 3-inch mortar right in the middle of the shack. And, they killed I don't know how many. But Smeltz got it. And one of the Mitchells got it. There was two brothers. They're both lieutenants. And one of them got it, or he was badly wounded. And if there was anybody wounded, the following morning they took us out. That's right. If there was anybody wounded, there was no way. Just... stay there, because I knew what they were going to do. They killed him. There's no doubt about it. And this Mitchell was wounded badly, and his brother wouldn't leave him. So I guess they killed his brother, too. We've never heard of that since. So, I was with Lieutenant McKillop. He was a funeral director from Portage. And he was badly wounded, but he was smart enough that he didn't let on. So he got out of there, but he only lasted a few days, and we didn't last that long, a day or two. So they took us out of there that morning. This would be about the 21st, I suppose, somewhere in there. And they marched us back right down to Up Park Camp, that's Jamaica, North Point. And they kept us there, and then they took us across to the mainland of Kowloon, and they made us parade in front of all the Chinese with all the wounded and the sick, and I was carrying we had a door, four of us, and we're carrying Lieutenant McKellop. He couldn't walk anymore. He was bleeding to death. And the blood was running off the door and running down our arms, you know, and there was nothing they would do for anybody who was wounded to hell with. So we prayed around Kowloon for a day or two, carrying some of the guys died, and we still kept praying. They were showing off the Chinese, their power and their might. And then when the hell did they put us in? In Argyle Street, I guess. It was an old refugee camp, full of Chinese, or had been. It was all full of straw and oil, and there was a bunch of Indians that had already been in there, and we got there. And because the war was still on, you see, we were captured ahead of time before the armistice. And then they mounted a bunch of big guns right outside of Argyle, right side of the camp, you know, and you see the planes going over and coming back and dropping where the targets were and all this stuff. And they didn't feed us nothing. We took all the leaves off the trees and the grass out of the ground and boiled it in little tin cans and anything. They never gave us a thing until the armistice was signed.
And when did you finally hear about the surrender, and who told you about it?
You mean the surrender of the island?
Yeah.
Gosh, I can't remember. I really don't remember. I know that they'd moved us to Shamshapo, and we were laying there on the floor in this, what they call the married quarters. Jubilee, no? Is that the name of that place? Jubilee Building? I forget. The married quarters, anyway. And I guess the only way we knew was when the main bunch of prisoners moved in, as far as I can remember. And they'd scrounged a bunch of food, you know, before they had them in their pockets and on their back and that. And then they got into Shanchipo, the main bunch. There was, I forget how many hundred. And they had to turn all this food in, you see, and put it in a special room. And while they were on parade counting them, well, we'd get into this room. And I know I got a 7-pound can of bully beef, and I think it ate it all myself. But that's the only thing I can say. I can't actually remember any way except when the main body came into the... Mm-hmm.
And then were you moved back to North Point Camp after that?
Yeah. I forget how long we're in Shamshapo. And then they moved us to North Point. And then we're moved back to Shamshapo again. This was all within a year. I remember right, because I know when I left Hong Kong for Japan, we were in Shamshapo Barracks.
And what was the daily life like in Shamshapo?
Oh, it was pretty well routine, I guess. We were working on Kai Tak Airport, hauling mud, you know, with coolies in the baskets, you know, and leveling off a big hill to make the runways longer and stuff like that with picks and shovels.
Was there any attempts of sabotage at this time when you were doing
not,
any work at the airport?
No, yes. As far as the concrete mix there was, I mean, a lot of it, there was so much concrete, we were mixing cement and we would make one batch, 10-1, and the other batch 1-1, you know what I mean? There was some strong places, but some awful weak ones, you know. Yeah, that's true. I forgot about that. Yeah.
And was there still some type of organization in the camp among the ranks with the officers?
Questions? Yes, in Shamshapo there was. Because they used to take the roll call. I'm not sure now. I can't really remember. Maybe that was just at North Point. I can't remember now.
And was there any attempt to escape by any of the men?
Oh yeah. That was North Point though.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was four guys over the wall or over the wire. But a lot of rumors and I what happened to them, none of us know. I know that George Brzezinski was one, and I had somehow or another during the Chamois before I was captured or after, I don't know, but I got a pair of these whipcord riding breeches. And I wasn't wearing them or anything, and he came to me and asked me if he could have them, and he told me what he was going to do. So I gave them to him. I mean, I wasn't wearing them because I still had my battle dress, I guess, or something, I don't know. But he and Ellis and Payne and who the heck was the fourth guy? I can't remember. They went over the wire, but they didn't get far. And of course, as far that at that time, I told them the next morning there was four missing or what happened. I don't. I've got my own opinion, but I.
What about sickness in Chamtrupo? What treatment did they have for any sicknesses?
No, they didn't have any. We had a place there they called the Agony Ward, and we had these, what they call electric feet, very, very, you know, and the fellas couldn't sleep, their feet were just jumping, and they were hot as a, you know, I don't know whether the medical profession even got an explanation for it today or not. But they couldn't, then they just holler and rave, and we had, what that's what I say, they called it the Agony Ward, but there was no treatment, there was no nothing. We did have an outbreak of diphtheria, and they brought in serum, which, as I was given to understand at the time, not knowing anything about it, that it was watered down, but it saved that many more lives than if you'd given a guy a full shot, you know. I had diphtheria, and in the 41, January 42, I couldn't see anything. I was practically blind. And at night, you'd look at a light, you know, and it looked as if it was a streak up like that. That's about all you could see. But it after I got to Japan, it improved. My right eye never did. But my left eye, it came back, and it's 100% today. But it was through the diphtheria. So our doctors told us. I don't.
What about entertainment or hobbies or anything? Did the men have any at this time in Chamtrupo?
Not really that I can remember. There may have been the odd fellow, but most of us were we were working in the Kaitak Airport, and we were tired, not much to eat. You more or less rested and slept as much as you could, you know. Yeah. Keep your energy up, mm-hmm. If I remember right.
And what about pay? Did you receive any pay at this time for working?
I don't think so, not in China. No. When we got to Japan, we got 10 cents a day or some damn thing. But I don't remember any money in China, because that'd be Chinese money, and I don't remember receiving any.
No. What about the Japanese personnel and the guards at this time? What were they like? Are there any that still stand out in your mind?
Well, as far as the guards go, they were actually didn't bother us that much if we didn't bother them, you know. They were very weird people, you can call them that. I remember one time, that something I never forgot, there was Chinese kid coming down the road. The guards didn't have that much to do because there was no way we could get out of there. If we did get out, we'd stand up like sore thumbs. We were about 2 feet taller than any of them. And but I remember one day this Chinese fella coming down the road on a bicycle, and for something to do, they knocked him off the bike and strapped him to a big tree. He didn't have any shirt on, he just had a pair of pants, and there was lots of rats there, and they caught this rat, and they got a piece of pipe about 2 feet long, and I suppose about 2-inch pipe, and they held it up against his stomach, and they put the rat in the end of the pipe, then they got some greasy rags, and they lit them, and they heated the pipe at the rat's ass end, and the old rat, he's chewing his way into this Chinaman's guts, you see, to get out. And they stand back and laugh like hell, you know. This is the way they kind of shows you how they think, you know. Oh yeah, that was a big entertainment afternoon for them guys.
And when were you sent to Japan, and how was the selection made as to who was going to go when?
I don't know just how the selection was made, but supposed to be those that were the healthiest, the ones that took to Japan. And I went there in about, well, it was the first draft out. Now, I don't know whether it was January or February of 43. Yeah, 43, I think. See, 41 was pretty near finished. We were there a year, so it'd be 43, I guess. And how the selection was made, I don't know. But I was on the first draft, and we went on the... what was the name of that boat? That was a hell of a trip. That was a good one. Tutumaru. And at that time I couldn't see very good, and I was walking, I suppose, towards the back. I was fairly lucky because they filled the hole with guys. And they could jam them down there so thick that they couldn't even sit down. They couldn't even lie down. And there was about 30, they couldn't get in the hole. There was no place for them to stand. So we were up on top deck in a kind of a mess hall, I suppose, laying on the floor, which was a lot better than those poor guys had. And the only way they fed them, they'd lower down a bucket of rice on a rope. And of course, the guys right under the hatches, they got the rice. The other fellows in the far corner, there was no way they could get it there was no bathroom facilities. Everything was just done standing up, and I forget now. I guess we were a week or so. I can't remember. From we docked it from Oda and all that, and went on to Japan. Went on to Japan in there, but it was a hell of a trip.
How many men were on board?
Oh gosh, maybe 1,000. But I shouldn't say, because I can't remember.
What happened upon your arrival in Japan? Where did they take you and how?
Well, they put us on trains, and we docked in Nagasaki. They put us on the trains, and they pulled all the blinds down. We didn't know where we were going, and we stopped at 2 or 3 different places. So many would be taken off there and taken off here, you know. And I went right up to just outside of Yokohama, Kawasaki, 3D.
And what was the life like there?
Well, we worked in a shipyard. It was pretty well routine. I mean, we were starving to death, and the guys dying every day. You never come in from work unless there was 2 or 3 dead, and malnutrition and beriberi and all this stuff, you know. They work just 8 hours a day and get very few days off.
Was there any sabotage?
Oh yeah, a little bit. Yeah, the place where we used to eat was a steel building that hadn't been standing more or less on legs, and above it was all the templates of the for marking out the parts of a boat, and we used to when we were, they'd bring the rations from camp for dinner, rice or potatoes, whatever it was. This is where we used to eat, you see, and there was a few lockers and one thing another in there and a stove or two, and we've been kind of sheeted in with plywood. It wasn't really out in the open. But one of the fellas, he rigged up a candle and had it all figured out how long it took to burn and one thing another. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, while this whole thing went up, the guy that got the credit for it had nothing to do with it. I don't want to talk about it because it can't prove anything. But the guy that got the credit for that, he wasn't the man that did it at all. The fellow that did it, he didn't want to say anything because when that happened, they had a pretty good idea it was one of us, but they couldn't prove anything. And then we had to eat out in a place where there was no shelter or anything, and a lot of guys developed pneumonia after that and died over it. And I know the guy that did it, he just wondered if he'd done the right thing, and he kept quiet. And but one of the fellas, the staff sergeant, he made a big noise when he came home and took credit for it and all that, but it wasn't him at all. You know. And then there was another fire started, but there wasn't that much chance to get away with anything, you know. And of course, some of the guys put riveting bolts, they'd miss the odd rivet, you know, and stuff like that. But other than that, it was pretty hard to. Yeah.
And what's the food like at this time?
Oh, about the same as it was all through the, you know, cup, bit of rice, that's about all you could say. You get the odd piece of fish and a little bit of watery soup, but all the guys were, you know, nowhere near what we should have, what we needed, but there wasn't that much change in rations from the start to the finish that I can remember.
What about Red Cross parcels? Did you receive any at all during your
life? Yeah, but at the time I could remember, I know very well that in the whole time we were there, we didn't receive two full ones each. They'd come in with so many, and you'd have to split it maybe three ways, four ways, and that, you know. But I don't blame the Red Cross, because I think that the you know, the Japs just stopped, you know, they took it themselves. I think they did their darnest to get in there. But there was no way that they could probably educate them fellows of what it's for.
What was the sickness like, and was there any medicine at this camp?
Lots of sickness. I don't remember much medicine. I can't remember any. They had a kind of a powder, looked like flour, they used to give you to get dysentery. But other than that, you know, we had Captain Reed there as a doctor, and he did everything he could, but I don't remember any medical supplies and any.
What about the Japanese guards at this camp? Were they any different from those that you had in college?
Not too much. Like, there was good ones and bad ones. The ones that were good, they had to be bad every now and again to keep their job. They didn't want to go to, you know, they had a pretty soft touch guarding us guys. And if they, you know, they were a lot more. They didn't want to be drafted into the army, and they were doing war work. And a lot of them had a little bit of human feelings about them, but they had to rip into us every now and again and make it look good as far as the top Japs were concerned, you know.
What about communications with the outside world? Was there any at all? Did you know what was going on, how the war was progressing?
Not too much at that time. We had the, I think it was the Nippon Times or something. It was a paper print in English. It was full of Japanese propaganda, you know. We had a chance to read this. They didn't mind us reading it, so we figured that most of it was lies, you know. So we were kind of, you know, we didn't believe half it, and we didn't pay too much attention to it, you know. I'm trying to think of when the Japs started coming in there with their bombs, but I forget when that was. That gave us a bit of a lift when the B-29s came over. Well, that was getting into be about March, I guess, of 45. Was in the earlier part.
Did you stay at Camp 3D right until the end of the war?
No, about in March I moved up to a place called Ohasi. It was a mining area, and they had a big smelter right on the coast called Kamishi. And we were in about 12 miles, I guess, in this mine. We worked underground in the mine there. That was the worst part of it. I was far worse than the fact you're working underground and had 5 miles to walk and 5 miles to come back, you know, and all uphill. And the rations were getting worse as the war went on. They could get worse. They weren't getting any worse. They were just getting smaller. It's the same stuff, aren't they?
And what about when the atomic bomb was dropped? Did you hear anything about it?
Gosh, I can't remember. See, as far as I was concerned, I remember at the time thinking, well, if they hadn't dropped the atomic bomb, why, the war was over anyway. There's no doubt about it, because as I said, in March of 45, they moved us to Ohasi. Well, about June, I guess, the American fleet came in and they leveled this, I don't know how many hundred or how many smokestacks there was at Kamishi in this big iron smelter. And they leveled the whole issue with ships first offshore. And I forget how many thousand Japs they killed. And they came down and to our camp and loaded a bunch of us up to go and bury these Japs. They were already buried, actually, because they were in holes in the ground. You know, they'd dig a hole in the ground for airage shelter and put some bamboo trees across and a bit of mud. And they were actually buried already. Their legs and arms and heads were sticking out and all that. And you could see the American Navy laying right off the shore there. And I think that was in about June of 45. But I can't remember when the atomic bomb was dropped, just how we found out about that. I can't remember.
What about the guards? Was there any change in them during the last few months of the war?
Not that I could see, no.
Was because the new set of men brought in or something?
No, not where we were, no. Not that I can remember. And of course they didn't, they figured they were winning the war to the last minute anyway, you know. They were pumped up with so much propaganda, they didn't know the difference. They even figured they had troops fighting in California. They figured, oh yeah, they didn't have any clue. No.
And how did you finally find out about the Japanese surrender?
Well, we were coming off shift, coming out of the mine. This particular afternoon, I guess. Yeah, about 4 o'clock. And the mines there, they're in the side of a hill. They go in at different levels. They're not straight down. You walk in maybe a mile into the side of a mountain. So we're coming out. We're still into this mountain coming out. And the guards are excited. And we understood enough Japanese that between the bunch of us, we had it figured out that the war was over. So when we came out, there was other crews. Some of them were working in the electrical end of it. Some were working in whatever part of the mine it was. And we all came out in the same street, you see, and were marched back to camp. And they all the guys had smiles on their face, you know, and course, they didn't say too much because we're still under guard. But the next morning, well, there was no work, so we. And not only that, I'm ahead of myself. We had Ohassee. We had the crew off the American Houston that was sunk in the off Singapore, I believe it was, and they had a radio, and they didn't turn on every day long, no, maybe every 10 days or something, you know, but we were expecting it because of the fact that there was a radio in the camp, you know. But we had a lot of Javanese in there from Java, and they had to be really careful because they didn't trust these guys, you know. And they had to be careful of who they told their news to, and if these guys would sell you out.
When did the Americans finally come to the camp?
Well, I got sick of waiting for him. I was one that I took off, and others took off too. But they went to the local railroad station in Ohassee, and the Japanese civilian police now had orders not to let anybody out of camp, pick them up. That was the first bunch that tried to get out, and. So when we got a smart idea, we knew there was we were working in the mine in Ohassee. There was a big cable car thing come over from way over the hills. We didn't know where, but we knew there was life over there. So we took off and went way over the hills and got into a small place. I don't know the name of it. And we went into the station there, and all they ran out of there was ore cars out to the main line. We told the guy there who we wanted to get to Tokyo, and we didn't want any trouble with them, and we weren't going to give them any. And he was nice as heck, and he got a civilian police, and he escorted us right to the main line, and then there was another police, and he got on to so far more. We were on a passenger coach by this time. We told him we didn't want to be crowded either, because the Japanese trains, they just load them like flies, you know. They're on the outside and all over. We had lots of room. And they put a policeman on with us and took us right down to Tokyo. There was six of us, I think. So we got through to Tokyo that way and met up with the American army there. And so then they flew us, and we were on the Iowa overnight, I think so. And then they flew us to Guam, put us in the hospital there. We were there about 12 days, I guess.
And what was done there? Was it a medical checkup?
Yeah, there wasn't that much done. It was more, they kind of specialized, you know, giving us good food. And that's about all I can remember. Now, maybe there were some others that were sicker than I was that had different attention, but I can't really remember that.
And when you left Guam, how did you travel? Did you go by boat or by plane? And where was your next stop over there?
It was in San Diego. Went in the U.S. SLMR by boat to San Diego.
Mm. And then did you stay in San Diego for?
No, they moved us to up the coast north to a place called Camp Hon, just outside of Riverside. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what happened here?
Well, we took off and went to Riverside. No, wasn't that much. We weren't there that long, and we were put on a passenger train and brought up the coast to Victoria. Mm-hmm. Well, we had to bum money and everything. It was the Canadian Army, the Canadian government couldn't. In fact, I guess they were mad that we ever come home. But they gave us $10. I think it was in. I think it was Camp Hon. Yeah, we got $10. Big deal. We spent that in Riverside in about 10 minutes. And we had to bum money, like we got to Seattle on the train, and we just missed the ferry. So we had, I forget how many hours to wait. None of us had any money, so we went to American Red Cross. Told them about it, and it was about 50 Canadians, I guess, by this time. And away we didn't have any money to spend, so went to the American Red Cross and explained it to them and told them we'd have to take our word for it, we'd send it to you when we get home. And they did. They gave us $10 or whatever it was each, and we had a day in Seattle while we were waiting to get across to Victoria. And we got to Victoria, and incidentally, in the meantime, we had an Australian officer who was kind of boss and was bringing us home. And so we got to Victoria, and they had an old Winnipeg Electric bus there. It ran, that's about all you could say, and they gave us a card and a rotten apple from the welcome home, the people of Winnipeg, British Columbia. Never forget that. And we were coming through San Diego, or from San Diego up the coast on the train, and the Americans were throwing cartons of cigarettes through the windows, you know, and bottles of whiskey, and I forget how much cigarettes and whiskey I shipped in a kit bag from Victoria. Oh yeah, what a difference.
And what happened in Victoria?
We were put in Gordon Head Camp, and I was held up there as a dysentery carrier, unfit to travel. Yeah, they kept me there for 2 weeks. Yep.
And were you issued new uniforms here?
Yeah.
And then from Victoria, where did you go?
When I left Victoria, there was only two of us. The others had gone on, and Bill Jeffrey and I guess he was held up for the same reason as I was. There was only two of us, and they took us across, and we got on the train to Vancouver. Yeah, and they headed for Winnipeg.
And when did you arrive back in Winnipeg? The date was it?
October 24th,
45. Mm-hmm. And, when you got back to Winnipeg, did you have to go into Deer Lodge for treatment of anything?
That was October. I went in, I was having chest trouble. And I went in, and they kind of laughed at me or made me feel as if I shouldn't be there. And I came home. Oh, and I didn't get discharged in February. They didn't know what to do with us. We were kind of a bug. So I got discharged in February. Well then, I guess that spring, I was having chest trouble. And I went in and, as I say, they made me feel as if I shouldn't be there or nothing wrong. So I came home and I guess it was a year later. My chest was getting worse and I went to the local doctor and he said to me, he says, what are you doing here? Well, I said, where else would I go? Well, he says, you should be at Deer Lodge. Well, I said, they don't seem to want me there, at least that's the feeling I got. Well, he says, I'll write him a letter. So he wrote him a letter, and the first thing I knew, they called me in. And I was there about 2 or 3 weeks, I guess, and they gave me kind of seven, and I don't know what all.
When were you discharged?
February of 46.
And when did you return to work?
Oh, yeah, you know, practically immediately. See, as I said before, I was on the farm, and when I came home, my dad wasn't that good, and he was getting old, so I asked him, are you going to sell me the farm? He said, yeah. So, actually, before I got my discharge, I was monkeying around. I bought two or three sows that were in pregnant, and I started right in, actually. I didn't, in fact, for about 2 years, I never left the farm. Just to come down with the groceries, never had a car to come in with a tractor, pick up groceries and go home.
And, what about family adjustment? What was this like after the war?
You better ask the wife about it. Helen?
No comment.
It was a little rough. Yeah. Oh, I used to wake up in the middle of the night, holler and shout and fight and hit my knuckles on the wall. That only lasted a while.
And how is your general health today? Is it pretty good?
No. It could have been if they'd have used their bloody heads after the war. I kept on farming, and I was spending, two or three times a year I'd be in the hospital and depending on a hired man and arguing and fighting and with the doctors in there, and for a long, long time it was terrible. Lately it's been good. They kept telling me, well, get off the farm. I had this chest trouble, and I had 50 head of cattle and a milk contract with Modern Dairies and hauling bales and cripes. I was getting worse, and then get off the farm. And I had a 30% pension. How the hell could I get off the farm? So then they raised it to 70%. And it hadn't been for Dr. McDonald. He's the best man that Deer Lodge ever had. And then 6 years ago, they raised me to 190, sold the farm, which I didn't want to do. But I can't kick lately, not a bit. But I have to go in once or twice a week and go on a machine in there. And of course, they pay my gas. I can't kick them. But for a long time, and they make you. And if you blew your cork, they send you to a psychiatrist. Yeah, you're haywire.